This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto here at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium in Pasadena, California. We're coming to you from Southern California. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I don't have to tell you this is the home of the film and fantasy industry. And we're going to talk about the intersection of science, technology, and the art of film and television production. And we're going to start with some perspective, with some history. More than 50 years ago, an MIT engineer named Ivan Sutherland, he had a really a prescient vision. He was using a Cold War computer, one of those old big computers, to track Soviet missiles, and he created the first computer program to make animated drawings. He called it Sketchpad. And this was the interesting prescient part that he had. He wrote in his thesis, Sketchpad need not be restricted to engineering drawings. It might be exciting to try to make cartoons. So you fast forward half a century, and animators no longer use pen, pencil, and brush to sketch and color their animations. Computer animation is a multi-billion-dollar business. But my next guest says we never would have known the Navi, Buzz Lightyear, or Shrek without those first pioneering scientists and engineers. And he ought to know because he covers the whole waterfront in that history. Tom Cito is the professor of cinematic practice at the University of Southern California. He is also a veteran animator. He worked on Disney classics like Little Mermaid, right? Beauty and the Beast, Lion King. His book is called Moving Innovation. It is a history of CGI. Tom, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
How far back do you go in
animation? Well, I started in animation in 1975. One of the first movies I worked on was a musical called The Animated Raggedy Ann and Andy. At the time, in terms of technology, I think the most advanced thing we had at that time was electric pencil sharpeners. It's a big deal. You didn't have to turn
the crank. State of high tech.
Yeah. You don't have to turn the little crank. It's great. So. Yeah.
Did anyone see the coming of the great digital revolution that came after that?
Well, it's interesting because when we were working on that film, we were working on it in Midtown Manhattan, and we were aware that over in Westbury, Long Island, there was a group of scientists working with computers, and they were going to try and make a cartoon with computers. And that just seemed so far-fetched because in our minds, computers were like things that James Bond used or Dr. No or something like that. And right. The idea that you would make like soft bunnies and funny rabbits and, you know, and things like that. It just seemed, unbelievable.
I remember that back in 74 at the Oscars, Francis Ford Coppola tried to tell you all that something was going to happen and no one believed it?
Yeah. Francis got up at the Oscar ceremony, and because he had won for Best Picture the previous year for The Godfather, it was his right to give out the Best Picture for that year. And usually it's the last Oscar of the evening and everybody's tired and you want to go to your party and you want to have a drink or whatever, you know. And anyway, so Francis got up and launched into this manifesto of the coming of digital cinema, where he said this thing is coming called digital cinema. It's going to change everything we do. Film itself will be, you know, an anachronism. It'll disappear. And everybody thought he was nuts. And they were just thinking, like, shut up. We want to go to our party, you know.
And he was prescient about that.
Yeah. You know, he saw it. He saw it coming.
And the military was also very interested in early computer graphics.
Yeah, people don't realize this, but a lot of early progress in computer graphics was done by the military because the Cold War was a war of scientists versus scientists and technology versus technology. In the past, when they used to have airplane flight simulators, you'd have a thing that kind of looked like a phone booth and the pilot got in it and it had oars and the guys would rock it back and forth on car springs. I'm flying a plane, ooh, you know. And you know, now it's a well, we have supersonic jets and we have breaking the sound barrier. That's not good enough for training. So the government put a lot of money in virtual reality so that when a pilot would turn the controls of his plane, the landscape in front of him would turn also.
Hmm. So I understand then it was actually an aerospace engineer who coined the term computer graphics?
Yeah, there was a fellow named William Federer who was an engineer at Boeing around 1960, and he was designing ergonomically comfortable seats for fighter pilots, for a cockpit seat. And in order to do this, to work it out with a computer, he had built the first wireframes of a human being so that he could figure out the right posture and all. And like anything you do in the government, eventually you have to turn in an expense account and a budget, you know. And the government people were asking, what are you doing? Like, what do you call it is that you're doing? And he went, computer graphics? And that's the name.
Is there a line item for that?
Yeah, and he named it. You know, he's the one.
In fact, I remember having covered a lot of the early JPL flights and missions of Voyagers and things like that back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. It was down the road a piece here, right, at JPL, where the public first saw stuff that NASA was making in the computer graphics field.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the 60s, you know, Hollywood didn't believe in, like, what scientists call blue sky research. And blue sky research is basically, you know, give them a couple million dollars and tell them to get lost for 2 years, and we'll bring you back something really cool. The military didn't mind that, but Hollywood studios, this is like anathema. They're just like, what are you talking about? You
know? Yeah, and in fact, I guess if you're NASA and you've spent billions of dollars on spacecraft that are going out into space, you have to have some pictures to show people.
Yeah. So, you know, in 1977, when NASA launched the Voyager spacecrafts to the outer planets, it would take about 3 years until they got to anything interesting to look at. And during that time, NASA worried. They said, well, what if the Voyagers get there and the cameras don't work? Or something gets stuck, or the transmission doesn't happen. We just, you know, have to go to the public and say what they just spent $3 billion on. You know, we need a simulation explaining exactly what the Voyager is going to be doing. And the artists who were hired by JPL to create the simulation, they would use computers. And like they said, we didn't have a script or a storyboard. We had the mission plan. That was our storyboard.
You single out the Genesis effect from Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, as one of the first breakthrough CGI scenes. Mm-hmm. So we're going to watch a clip of that. Tell us what's happening in the scene, the clip that we're going to watch.
So what the Genesis effect was that in that second Star Trek, they're fighting over this device called the Project Genesis, and it's a way to resuscitate sort of dead planets and cover them with foliage and life and all. And originally, the studio, when it engaged ILM to try and create this process, originally they said, well, the clients would have been happy if you showed time-lapse moss growing on a rock. You know, they would have loved that. But the artists at the Lucasfilm Graphics Group, which later became the engineering arm of Pixar, they decided, well, we want to really show what we can do on a major motion picture, and we want to put everything that we know into this. So of some of the things that they had learned on Project Voyager.
All right, let's look at that clip. We'll talk about it.
It is our intention to introduce the Genesis device into a pre-selected area of a lifeless space body, a moon or other dead form. The device is delivered, instantaneously causing what we call the Genesis effect. Matter is reorganized with life-generating results. Instead of a dead moon, a living, breathing planet capable of sustaining whatever life forms we see fit to deposit on it.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. Now, yeah. It's interesting to look back. That was state-of-the-art in 1982.
Oh, that was breakthrough stuff. That was really hot.
What was breakthrough about? Yeah. What did they do that was such a breakthrough?
Well, before that, any kind of CG, you know, any kind of computer graphics were hard geometric shapes, you know, very smooth-looking shapes. And this was the first time where, you know, they developed a software called bump mapping, where you could put surfaces on an irregular shape, like a mountain range. And another thing they created was fractals. And fractals was a way to describe things like fire and water and smoke and all, which, you know, again, weren't solid geometrics.
Mm-hmm. So did all the NASA engineers say, hey, there's a burgeoning business in films, let's go get some real money? I mean, did they leave and go to the movie industry?
Well, I think some of them stayed at NASA because they just, you know, they love NASA. You know, they didn't want to leave and all. But it's interesting that right around the time at the end of the Vietnam War, there was a bill down in the quote-unquote military-industrial complex where they wound up cutting the budgets for a lot of these, you know, blue sky programs, and computer graphics was like some of the first stuff. So a lot of those engineers and scientists who were leaving leaving the military, you know, migrated into the private sector in time to influence the creation of computer graphics.
Let me talk about Toy Story for a second. Toy Story came out in 1995. The CGI was still primitive compared to what we have today, but it looks so polished, though. It's still, how did Pixar do that?
Yeah, they did a magnificent job with it. And what they wound up doing was that, at the time, a lot of scientists and artists who were trying to create films with CGI were going for full photorealism. They were trying to make it look just like human beings and all. And the technology wasn't really there yet. And what Pixar did was they worked to the limitations in the medium. So they thought, okay, so the shapes look sort of shiny and polished and don't look, you know, organic. So do toys. You know, so that works.
Because people expect to see toys looking like that, and so you give them that state of the animation.
It makes sense,
What about Star Wars, or 2001, A Space Odyssey? Those, do they make your list of as the greatest animation or not?
Well, I mean, they have beautiful animated effects in it, but both Star Wars, the first Star Wars and 2001 have very traditional effects. I mean, effects that would have been used in the 1940s. There's a great anecdote about one of the production assistants was standing on the set next to Arthur C. Clarke, and this is like 1967 because the film came out in 68. They were looking at that enormous set that they had built of the interior of the spaceship, and Clarke was standing there, and he goes, "My boy, you see all this technology. Someday the power of all these computers and all this technology will be down to a chip the size of your fingernail." And he goes, "We thought he was nuts."
Well, does anybody use hand animation like you do anymore? Is it a dead art?
It's still there. I mean, there's still this traditional animation being done. Every once in a while, a film comes out. Like, I think there's a SpongeBob movie that's being made now that's a hand-drawn film. It's sort of like, you know, saying, like, you know, will photography replace painting? You know, it's like it's another medium, so it's another way of looking at film.
Well, Tom Cito, thank you for taking time to be with us. Fascinating. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tom Cito is professor of cinematic practice at the University of Southern California. His book about the birth of CGI is called Moving Innovation. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a conversation with Hollywood writers about telling stories with science. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.